Hello and welcome to the Majlis Radio for Your Pride Liberties Current Affairs podcast focusing on Central Asia. I'm Mohammed Tahir, the host of the Majlis podcast and Radio for Your Pride Liberties media manager here in Washington, D.C. Last weekend on July 25th, we woke up to a horrific news from Kyrgyzstan that was about the death of Azimjan Askarov in prison at the age of 69, who was, despite repeated calls from the international community, was kept in jail. His death created lots of emotional reactions around the world. Human Rights Watch said the Kyrgyz authorities to be responsible for his death, and the chairman of the U.S. Helsinki Commission has also lamented his passing. As much as his death is tragic, there are a number of people who are still kept in an unhealthy environment in Central Asian jails. Their lives couldn't be more at risk today, given the surge in COVID-19 pandemic in the region. Authorities in Central Asia are keeping them behind the bars in defiance of all calls, as did the Kyrgyz authorities, which ended in the tragic death of an old man who didn't belong there in the first place. To discuss all these today on the Majlis, I'm joined by a number of people. Some of them spent years in jail, some fought for their release, and some reported about the inhuman condition in which they kept in those facilities. So let me welcome Aygul Bekcan, who's joining us, along with her father, Mohammed Bekcanov. He's well known as the world's longest imprisoned journalist, who spent 18 years in jail in Uzbekistan before he got released in 2017. We also have Yevgeny Zhotis, the director of the Kazakhstan-based International Bureau for Human Rights in the Rule of Law, who himself spent a couple of years in jails in Kazakhstan. Steve Severlo is with us, who's the associate professor of the practice of human rights at the University of Southern California. Steve is also a consultant with the UN agencies in Central Asia and formerly Human Rights Watch's Central Asia researcher. And Bruce Panier, the editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia blog, Kishlok Owazi. Thank you, colleagues, for joining us today. So let's start with the news about the death of Askarov. And I would like to give microphone to Mohammed Bekcanov. Mohammed Eka, please tell us, what was your impression when you heard of Askarov's death?
Ну, я очень переживал, конечно, как потом я предполагал, как видишь, вот.
I was incredibly worried, and I felt all the pain that he went through, because, you know, I expected this outcome, unfortunately, because I lived through it myself, and I thought this the same thing is going to happen to me, and I will just die in prison. And I've heard that he was very sick, and I was sick in prison as well. In 2014, I was in the same position, maybe not the same disease, but I was in the same position. And my wife knows how I felt, and I couldn't speak, I couldn't walk, I was bedridden. So I was lucky to actually stay alive. So I lived through it all over again. And at that time, I thought I'm going to die as well. So, and I was upset with my wife that she wasn't able to bring my kids to say goodbye to everyone. So I can only imagine what they all went through.
Well, thank you very much, Aygul, for the translation. Thank you, Mohammed Eka. Given both of you were involved in documenting human rights abuses leading up to your detention, it's a striking example of the challenges of being a human rights defender or an independent journalist in Central Asia. So, Steve, you have been one of the most active activists in defense of Askarov. So what was your impression when you heard of his passing?
Well, I want to start by expressing my condolences to Khadija Pa, his wife, and also his sons. This is one of the darkest moments in the modern history of Central Asia, because as many other colleagues at human rights organizations, experts, and relatives of Askarov have expressed, his death really is on the hands of the Kyrgyz authorities, who for 10 years showed remarkable cruelty in this case by allowing a man who was very transparently imprisoned on political grounds to remain behind bars and die behind bars, knowing so well that his condition was deteriorating amidst the COVID-19 pandemic and much earlier, as early as 2012, we heard of just terrible reports of his health deteriorating. So he's been suffering for a long, long time up to this point. But, you know, as many have remarked, being someone that revealed and investigated police brutality, police corruption for so many years, and being an ethnic Uzbek, and just being, you know, a courageous human rights defender, put him in the crosshairs of the authorities well before his arrest in 2010 during the ethnic conflict in Osh. And so it's very clear that this was politically motivated. And when we call him a political prisoner, what we're really speaking about is our universal concepts of fairness that have been violated in these cases. And, you know, the Council of Europe does us a favor by actually defining a political prisoner. But I think it's very clear Azim Can Asgarov met all those criteria. And now, you know, we see even in his death, we're witnessing a struggle just to get his body buried closer to his sons, who now have relocated to Uzbekistan, and his wife hopes to move there. And even that, it has been proving a struggle over the past few days. So there's still no rest, still no peace. And I hope by the time this podcast is released, we'll have some further developments. I know the Uzbek side has made some statements that they're working towards an agreement regarding the burial of his body. Mm. But I think this case is really one of those that should remind us of the plight of political prisoners all across the region, and remind us of just how urgent it is to support the families, to pressure governments that are not living up to their their obligations, and to continue fighting for their freedom.
Yeah, you know, I mean, each of speakers on this panel have some memories about Asgarov. I would like to get your impressions too. But before that, Steve raised some important points. Let me follow up with something. Steve, I was reading comments by Asgarov's lawyer. It was pretty obvious that he was severely sick before his passing. He couldn't walk, he couldn't sleep, he couldn't eat, and he was 69 years old. So it must be pretty clear that his life was in danger. We are talking about the man who never belonged there in the first place anyway. So it's kind of beyond my level of comprehension to understand why authorities didn't do anything to save him. And also, what are the conditions he was kept in? I know you have some inside information about the facilities where he was kept all along.
Sure. No, and I should say that some of my other colleagues in the human rights community, like Gulnoza Said, you know, at the Committee to Protect Journalists, recently visited Asgarov in prison. I didn't get to meet him there, but, you know, I got to be in touch with his family and witness the courage of his wife, for example, who would go to the OSCE conferences over the past few years. And of course, Telikan Ismailova in Kyrgyzstan, the human rights defender who's been raising his case so courageously. You know, I think it is beyond comprehension, because I remember sitting in a courtroom in Bishkek in 2015, I think it was, or 2016, when the UN Human Rights Committee clearly stated that Asgarov's arrest was clouded, tainted by torture, and that clearly he should be released. And they called in no uncertain terms on the Kyrgyz authorities to release him. And the defiance and the actually also Zhenya Zhovtis on this podcast, I think you were also there, if I remember correctly. Many, many human rights defenders were there. And I think we were all taken aback by the aggressive, defiant, blatantly defiant behavior of Bishkek, which so often gets praised among the other Central Asian countries for more openness, democracy, and human rights. But in this case, you know, I think we all felt a racism, a very cowardly explanation that I would often hear from Kyrgyz authorities that, you know, if we do let him free, you know, then we risk some sort of ethnic outbreak or instability in the south of the country. And other times, you know, you would marvel even at people like Roza Otunbayeva, you know, a progressive leader, former president of Kyrgyzstan, who would say, that's the decision of our courts. And she would lament it and hint that it wasn't right, but that nothing could be done. And I think that was unacceptable then. Mm. It's unacceptable now. And, you know, we're all pushing for everyone involved in this case to be held accountable.
Right.
Because, as you said, it is beyond comprehension.
Mm-hmm. Bruce, I will come back to you with this question, the attitude of the Kyrgyz authorities when it comes to this case. But before that, Yevgeny, Steve mentioned your name. It sounds like you have had some interaction with Asgarov or familiarity with his case. So tell us about what you recall about this man, or tell us about your own struggle for justice in favor of Asgarov.
First of all, of course, I could follow Steve with the deepest condolences to Khadija, whom I know very well. And I visited Kyrgyzstan several times, and twice I took part in these trials, one trial in Bishkek in the Supreme Court, and another trial in Bozor Korgon. which was about his property and something like that, and we talked to Khadija a lot and so on. Of course, it was a terrible story, and we were involved deeply, and I agree with Steve about the courageousness and what Kyrgyz human rights defenders were doing, and Tolikan Ismailova, Aziza Abdurasulova, who were trying to raise this issue even when they were verbally attacked and even physically attacked by some nationalistic groups in that case. It is a very difficult case, and of course a lot of things were around which are of political nature. And to a certain extent, it reminds me the case in Kazakhstan. We have absolutely the similar case. Fortunately, the person is alive, but the case of Aron Atabek, who is spending in prison for already 14 years, being sentenced to 18 years, also is 67 years old, and also is in a very bad health. The case of Askarov shows the nature of these political regimes, the way how they are handling these cases. And what is for me most important in that regard is the reluctance or the refusal to follow their international commitments and obligations, because there were the decisions of the UN Human Rights Committee. There was so many calls for release of Askarov, including the issue of his health and any kind of humanitarian grounds for that. But it is unfortunately, how they are dealing with such kind of regimes and such kind of elites in power.
Right.
And this is a serious problem for many political prisoners, including in Turkmenistan, Vardan Dapay, or Uzbekistan, in the case of Bekjanov. It's a lot of such cases which had certain similarity.
Right. Now, we are going to come to those cases in a moment. Bruce, talking of Askarov, of course, he passed away now. But from the moment, as earlier Steve was referring to, from the moment he was jailed until this government, none of the Kyrgyz administration authorities were open even to the idea of taking a second look into his case. It's a chilling sort of a reminder that perhaps Askarov was the only matter that they all were united. Else, they are enemies of each other. They are throwing each other to jails, forcing into exile in the case of the former president. So what was this? I could never understand this unity among Kyrgyz authorities on Askarov.
I would call it common fear. I think that was the thing. Steve kind of hinted at that before. There was so much nationalism that was laid on top of Askarov's case that, for ethnic Kyrgyz politicians, there was just no one with the courage to actually stand up and say, this man has been wrongfully jailed. I think they believed it was political suicide to do so. It was too bad because, again, we give this government credit for being the most democratic in Central Asia. And yet there was no one with the courage to step forward and say, look at what everyone else is saying. Maybe we're wrong about this. Maybe let's take a look at this. Now, it wasn't like there was many, many other trials involved with this. He appealed his sentence. They reviewed the sentence, a lot of things. So it was all kinds of chances for them to someone in the government to step forward and to say, this is simply wrong. And then maybe we would have had more support for freeing him. But unfortunately, no one had that kind of courage. And they sat there and did nothing. Yeah. While this man decayed in prison.
Yeah, and maybe it will sound like a name calling, but in situation like in Kyrgyzstan, that person who would have courage to say anything, I can't see anyone else other than the president. Let's see if he does. Aygül, I'm sorry, I'm keeping you in waiting. Please tell your dad if he wants to say anything on Askarov, he should feel free to jump in anytime. I will get to you and your dad's story very soon. But let me also ask this: the circumstances in which Askarov was detained. He had a cause. And his cause was to document the tragedy during and aftermath of an incident which led to the killing of hundreds of people in Osh. Now that he passed away, Steve, what about his cause, his struggle? Anything, his struggle, his suffering changed in that region?
Well, he started an organization back in 2002 called Vozduch, Air. And, what they had a very simple mission, which was to uncover corruption, police brutality, torture, and I mean, his commitment to justice led to several police officers being convicted, thrown off the force, people getting out of detention when they shouldn't have been there in the first place. And often, as we mentioned, you know, he was focusing on the ethnic Uzbek minority population of southern Kyrgyzstan. And you know, this work, this courageous work, which was very effective, and I think you know, people like Zhenya, you know, witnessed it more closely and for longer than I did, was so effective that he managed to earn some really serious enemies in the security services and in the police. And I think the, you know, the legacy of his work certainly lives on. And unfortunately, there's still an undetermined number, but I think it's in the hundreds, at least the dozens, of ethnic Uzbeks that were detained at the time of the Osh violence, who were really disproportionately targeted in the aftermath of the violence. Of course, there were also Kyrgyz that were detained in the aftermath of the violence, but a much larger group of ethnic Uzbeks. And I think, you know, were Askarov at liberty and alive today, if he hadn't been in prison these past 10 years, I think many of those people probably would have gotten out just by that one man and his amazing ability to raise cases. And I think that's one of the reasons why he was kept where he was, so that this really painful history that still 10 years on, as you discussed in a recent podcast, the Kyrgyz government is so reluctant to look into and really discuss openly and in a way that's, you know, consonant with human rights, so that history doesn't come out. And so I think, you know, the importance of carrying on his mission, in addition to seeking justice for him, are both extremely important for the fate of Kyrgyzstan going forward.
Right. I don't know, Yevgeny, if you had a chance to speak to him or his relatives. Any final thoughts about what was the Askarov's own interpretation of his life story, his impact? Any word that you can add into this? I mean, what he thought about his struggle, about the outcome of his struggle, whether it was worth for the cause that he was fighting?
I talked to him several times, but mostly I was talking to his wife, to Khadija. And it's very simple. It's justice. It's very easy because when the person is looking for justice, it doesn't matter what education, profession you have. It's a question of justice. You are drawing the line between justice and injustice. Right. And if you see injustice, you are trying to raise your voice. You are trying to bring facts. Of course, he was, to a certain extent, the person who was recognized and respected in his community, Uzbek community, in the south of the country, the Osh region, the Bazar Korgon. And there was a number of people, these good guys like Valerian Zahidov, his lawyer, and some other people who were trying to raise their voice against the injustice, especially keeping in mind that all of us are dealing in the Central Asia with this post-Soviet type of special services and the law enforcement and police, which used to not to follow the law, but more to be very corrupted on one hand and very brutal on another, especially in such cases like in the Kyrgyz-Uzbek relations and so on. And that's he was trying to, let's say, to promote justice. And when you start to do so, it's like you couldn't stop it. It becomes the part of your life. It's not only the humorous defender in traditional sense, it's some kind of profession or what you're trying to do, but it became personal. It became the part of your life. Yeah. And this is what happens with him, in spite of the fact that before, he was not a lawyer or he was not the humorous defendant in that regard or civic activist to such extent. But at some point, fighting the injustice, you are coming to a certain way, drawing your life in a certain way.
Right. We started the conversation with Mohammed Bekjanov about Askarov, and let's end this chapter with his thoughts again about Askarov. Mohammed, now that he is no more with us, what legacy he left behind, and what, in fact, my question should be, what would be your last word should you have had a chance to see him before his death?
And first of all, of course, our condolences to his family. We're quite heartbroken over his death, and we know exactly what they're probably going through, or we're very close to understanding what they're going through, first and foremost. And he's in connection with his son, so he does talk to him, and he keeps in touch with him. I can't even think about what I could have told him. I was just so heartbroken that all I could probably do is to embrace him and and we would probably understand each other without words, because we know the system and we know how it's all going down, unfortunately. And there's nothing we could tell each other. We would probably understand each other just by looking and embracing each other, because we would share the same pain.
Wow. Thanks. Brave words from a brave man to another brave soul. Thank you, Mohammed Eka. Now, Askarov's death is a true tragedy, and there are many other tragedies in waiting in Central Asia, as there are numerous people who are put in prison under dubious charges. One of them is, of course, Mohammed Bekjanov, who's luckily out, but there are numerous others who are still there. Let's talk about them and the conditions in which they are kept behind the bars. Also, is there anything that can be done to help them in avoid Askarov's tragic fate? We will continue the Majlis podcast talking about these and many other questions very shortly. First, let me recap the debate that today on the Majlis podcast, I am joined by Aygul Bekjan, who is joining us along with her father, Mohammed Bekjanov, a former detainee in Uzbekistan, Yevgeny Zhovtis, the director of Kazakhstan-based International Bureau for Human Rights in the Rule of Law. Steve Severlo is with us, who is the associate professor of the practice of human rights at the University of Southern California, and Bruce Panier, the editor of Ready Free or Pray the Liberty Central Asia blog, Kishlok Owazi. I'm Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis and Ready Free or Pray the Liberty's media manager here in Washington, D.C., and we are discussing the situation of political prisoners in Central Asia. So let's start with Mohammed Bekjanov. Mohammed, you are out, but there are so many still in jail, though it has been some time since you are out of Uzbekistan, out of jail. But given that you were in prison for so long and that you've gone through so many things, how has been the transition from being a prisoner to a normal life, a free man?
I am still seeing nightmares about in prison. I wake up in cold sweats thinking that I am still in jail, of course. And of course, praise the Lord, and I am with the family, and it's not as scary anymore, and it's less intense, of course. After the nightmares, I wake up, and then realizing that I'm a free person at the moment, and I have my family next to me, I have this happiness coming back to me. But it's still difficult to adjust, of course, because it seems like I'm on a new planet with a new life, and it's been 3 years since I've been released, and it's still trying to get into norms, still trying to pick up the pieces.
Any specific memory which still haunts him that he still remembers, he will never forget?
That moment that I'm recalling in 2014, when I was so sick and I was bedridden in prison, I couldn't walk, I could barely talk, and my wife was actually able to visit me, and I was so upset because I was getting ready to die at the moment, of course, and I was just so upset that I couldn't say goodbye to my kids, and my weight was 47 kilograms with a height of 1 meter, 83 centimeters, so you can only imagine what it was like. There was no medical help. Nobody was attending to me. That's why I can understand the pain and everything Askarov went through, because I lived through it or through similar. Everything is being treated with analgen in prison. Every disease. There are no medical help. There is nobody attending to you. Nobody giving you help. So I was very sure that I was going to die. So this is the moment in 2014. And in 2009 also, I was tortured to the point when I forgot the names of my children. So this is also, it took me months to come back and actually starting to recall the names of my children. I can only remember my oldest daughter's name.
Sorry for reminding him all the nightmares that he has gone through. But in the memories of your father, we are kind of trying to understand or picture the type of treatment the other political prisoners in Central Asia might be going through, or Askarov might have gone through. Thank you very much for sharing those painful stories with us. Yevgeny, let me come to you. As the former prisoner, does any part of Mohammed Bekjanov's story sounds familiar to you?
First of all, I want to address some issue about the recovery, because the prisoners who spent in prison many years used to say that you need the same time being free to recover from your imprisonment. And my term could not be compared with Mr. Bekjanov's, but even for me, it was 3 years to recover from this prison experience and to come back to the normal life. Yes, of course, there is a big difference between the conditions in prisons in Kyrgyzstan or in Uzbekistan with the Kazakhstani prisons. The Kazakhstani prisons more transparent to a certain extent. We do have national preventive mechanism or public monitoring commissions, which are visiting prisons from time to time. And there is a certain attention to the political prisoners who are serving their terms, and there are certain visits, or they have the phone calls. At least there is some kind of this not so harsh conditions, in spite of the fact that the medical service is very weak in Kazakhstani prisons as well. But in general, it's clear that it is political. When you have this political motivation behind the imprisonment, it's pressing you anytime because you are not the same person as others. Mm-hmm. And you could not rely on the same treatment as others because you are political, you are under certain kind of surveillance. When I need to get some kind of medical examination, the head of our prison have to call to Astana to get the permission from the top, including top officials. This is not so harsh conditions in what Mukhabat is saying, but in general, you're unfree and you're under a certain kind of pressure. And the problem is that when you are getting out, it does not mean that you are free already if you are not moving to another country, because you get back if you are doing the same things what I'm doing. Again, being human rights defenders own, you're again under a certain kind of surveillance, under certain kind of bullying and so on, discreditation and so on and so on, which is familiar to many countries of the former Soviet Union, including Central Asia. Right. That's it's how the things are now.
Speaking of the prisoners and the facilities, Steve, this is the area you worked a lot in. Also, we have not yet spoken about another country, Tajikistan, and there are so many prisoners, political prisoners there. And also, on the top of the inhumane condition that we are talking about throughout Central Asia, and especially the case in countries like Tajikistan and Turkmenistan, perhaps Uzbekistan, maybe Kyrgyzstan, now we have COVID-19. What kind of risks are there in prisons these days when there is a surge of COVID-19? And also, speaking of, for example, recently in the case of Kazakhstan, there were protests and people were taken into custody for a while and they kept there. What are the chances that they are being put in danger?
They're extremely high. You know, we've seen reports of several prisoners in Tajikistan that possibly have COVID-19, including Rahmatullah Rajab, who's a member of the Revival Party of Tajikistan, the IRPT, a political prisoner and activist. And there are great concerns about all of the prisoners across Central Asia. Many political prisoners are often up in years, which places them at greater risk. Of course, Askarov was in that very category. And the prison conditions themselves in Central Asia, while there are differences, as Zhenya mentioned just now, they are some of the most dangerous places on Earth, even when you're not experiencing a global pandemic. And that's why there's been repeated calls by UNODC, many different institutions, to at the very least, transfer to house arrest many of these prisoners of concern during the pandemic, if not, of course, release them. And recently we saw a bipartisan group of Republican and Democrat senators, about 10 or so, calling on the presidents of all five Central Asian countries to release various political prisoners, also because of COVID-19. And they highlighted cases in Tajikistan, three cases in Turkmenistan, several cases in all of the countries. For example, in Kazakhstan, human rights defender Max Bakayev's case was raised. And, you know, of course, that's important that they're doing that. But, you know, if we take a quick tour for a second, we really have in mind here, you know, when we're speaking of Uzbekistan, there are hundreds, if not thousands, in fact, nameless individuals. You know, we know some of their names, but there are others who are, we would classify as religious prisoners. There are thousands of whose cases raise a lot of human rights concerns, and we would call them political prisoners. Tajikistan, hundreds, I would say. convicted on extremism and various terrorism charges that raised many concerns. And then, of course, Turkmenistan, we get into well over 100. And many of those cases of people completely disappeared. We don't know if they're alive or dead. You know, and then you know, we move to Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan, which we've just been discussing. So we're talking about a very large population of people across the region, all very much at risk for COVID-19, but also whose humanity, whose dignity is at stake every single day.
Yeah, Bruce, Steve touched upon this, and we were also earlier talking about Turkmenistan. I mean, especially when we talk about prisoners, like high-profile political prisoners, one person comes to mind is former Foreign Minister Sheikh Muradov. I guess we have no idea where he is about. And also, there is a notorious jail somewhere in the desert called Awadan and Depe. You know, it's not known much about. And is there any thoughts when it comes to Turkmenistan about the political prisoners, especially under current condition?
As painful as it is to think about what life must be like in any prison in Central Asia, Turkmenistan probably tops the list. You know, especially if someone like Borishik Muradov, who's now been in for, it's going to be 20 years pretty soon. When you're that level of a prisoner, clearly a political prisoner, at that point, when you get put into a Turkmen prison, I have always felt that the authorities put them there with the intent that they would die. You know, and I think that's part of the what's happened with Askarov in Kyrgyzstan too. I always had, a lot of us were hoping for the day when something, you know, good sense would prevail and they would let him out. But I always had this horrible feeling that there was some people in Kyrgyzstan who would just prefer that he died in prison. And in Turkmenistan, it's that way for dozens of people. They don't want them to come out. You know, life is horrible in those places. I've been working with the Turkmen service for years and years. I can remember them telling me stories about people who had to bribe the guards to open the door and let fresh air in to their cells because it was 50 degrees Celsius inside the cell. You know, I mean, it's that bad. So you can just imagine, you know, if illness starts to spread through there, these people are so low priority as far as trying to keep them alive. And in fact, you know, that might even be exactly what the government wants, that they wouldn't do anything to help them at all. Like I said, Askarov's case does compare a little bit with, like I said, I always had the feeling that there was some people in Kyrgyzstan that just preferred he would die. And, you know, so I'm very happy to see all the criticism about that because it was a horrible case, and hopefully it will have some effect on their behavior and really all the behavior of all the governments in Central Asia going forward to realize the condemnation they're in for. And this is going to hurt Kyrgyzstan going forward. And I hope that all the other governments learn the lesson that if the other high profile prisoners that people have been calling for them to be released for years, if they actually die in prison, they can expect that the relations they have with other countries will be reduced and worsen immediately.
Right.
Can I just jump in real quick? Because sure. You got me thinking about Mohammed Bigjanov, who's, you know, on the line, and Aigul. His case, I think it's so good that he's on this program and that he's been able to talk about his story. Right. We had an experience where we went to Washington, D.C. after he was free, and it was so amazing to go into some Senate offices with Mohammed Akeh and see him embrace, you know, some of the congressional staffers that worked on the case together. And, you know, I just want to stop here for a second and say that his experience in some ways, while one of the most horrific in Central Asia, it's so important because, you know, Mohammed, you were kidnapped from your home in Ukraine, put on a plane in hog ties and tortured. And then put in a kangaroo court trial and then sent to Jaslik prison, which up until very recently was operating in Uzbekistan. Now it's at least temporarily closed. And it was called the House of Torture because it was notorious for breaking people down, especially political prisoners. And I think there were many moments, if I remember, Mohammed Akeh, when we spoke about how you were given opportunities to, quote, ask for forgiveness, unquote, and you never broke. You remained true to your principles as a journalist up until, luckily, thankfully, we saw the death of a dictator, and you were released. And even after that, Zhenya here has mentioned, very importantly, the lack of rehabilitation and resources and the pressure and the bullying that political prisoners, when freed, experience. And, you know, for well over a year, Mohammed Akeh, you know, you were restricted in your travel movements when we met in Uzbekistan. And little by little, you know, you emerged from that situation and you reunited with your family. But I'm so happy, I'm so inspired by your work, and now you're writing a book about your experiences. And Aigul, just want to say thank you as well to you for raising his case in so many different capitals in Washington, D.C., and in Warsaw for so many years.
Let's take Aigul's point on that. I mean, Mohammed Akka is out, and we are so glad to be talking to him right now. There is also an element, an advocacy element, a struggle behind, which led to this outcome of Mohammed Akka being out. Aigul, tell us about your own struggle in support of your dad, in support of his release. What did you do? How did you do? Some of your memorable moments in the struggle.
Of course, it was incredibly difficult because it took years, and you get so disappointed and discouraged because you do certain things and then you see the thick-skinned officials that, you know, don't want to help you or pretend that they do, and then nothing is happening. Nobody wants to really do anything. And this work wouldn't be possible without people like Steve Sverdlov, to tell the truth. He was the one who was constantly encouraging and pushing me and organizing all these meetings. And I'm just so thankful for his help because I think he's very incredible. There are, of course, other people, but he did a lot. So if it was not for him, we wouldn't be able to do it. So, and of course, I was disappointed so many times, and I was telling him, you know, it's useless. It's useless. Nobody wants to listen. And even if we do something, and even if we write officials and countries like Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, or Kazakhstan, they don't want to listen. They don't want to do anything. But he still was very persistent, so I'm glad he did it. I'm thinking that still, it did benefit my dad in certain things because, you know, they at least kept him alive.
Mm.
Although I think it's a miracle because, you know, he's saying, yes, I am free and I'm happy to be alive, not just to be free. I'm happy to be alive because there were so many moments that I was sure that I'm gonna die in prison. I'm going to rot in prison.
Yeah, truly. And we are so happy that Mohammed Akka is out. And also so sad that Askarov, another human rights defender, has passed away. But this is also a moment where we have to think about what works when it comes to pushing Central Asian authorities to do something that they don't like. Yevgeny, you as a human rights organization, what works? I mean, what can be done about all the other people who are still in jail?
It's very difficult to say because it's very individually, and it depends on the general political context. I used to say that in the modern world, the Kazakhstan, for example, has four enemies of democracy, rule of law, and human rights, and these are oil, gas, war on terror, and geopolitical considerations. And unfortunately, Kazakhstan has all four. And it's very difficult with such kind of economical ties, real politics, very cynical position of a number of high-rank officials in Europe, in Brussels, in Washington, and so on, to reach something. But in general, we have to move forward. Aigul is right. Sometimes we are absolutely desperate. Sometimes you think that nothing could be done. Again, Steve already said about Mark Zhukbakayev, the Aron Atabek. Hopefully, this year, Mukhtar Jakishev, who spent in prison more than 10 years, was released. It was a long, long struggle. Anytime we have to look into some kind of internal political process, in some kind of change in power, some changes in the government, plus what they need in the West. They are still caring a lot about their image, about their interests, especially economical, about security and so on. Keep in mind that Kazakhstan is trapped between Russia and China. It's another some kind of leverage. It's combination. It's the combination of different tools. I practically travel a lot every year to Brussels, Vienna, Washington, I don't know, London. Paris, trying to convince people to support certain concrete cases, concrete individuals, raising the issues, trying to bring the cases to the UN Human Rights Committee. We have to use, trying to use everything. The problem is that finally that these leverages are not so strong. Anytime when you're coming to Berlin with all this, or Bonn with all this type of real politics governing the German policy, it's very difficult to push through. But sometimes it works. As in the former Soviet Union, sometimes Korvalan is, let's say, so transferred with the Bukovsky. Sometimes you could do something. You have to try, but in any case, it's very, very, very individual.
I think we also need to be wrapping up the discussion very soon. So let's end it with one final comment. Now that Askarov is dead, under these circumstances, what should be takeaway for us for anyone who are in the position of influence. Let's start, Bruce, with you, and then I would like to take, you know, point of views from all of you.
Well, you know, one, you just can't give up. I mean, you know, we've seen in the case of Muhammad Bakhjan that relentless pressure, change in leadership finally did lead to his release. Relentless pressure didn't work for Azimjan Askarov, unfortunately, but we'll have to see what kind of penalties Kyrgyzstan is going to have to pay for or suffer for what just happened here. I mean, really, I think this is a moment where, you know, democratic governments really need to draw some kind of line here and say, you know, we had told you and there has to be some kind of repercussions for not doing this. And hopefully that will be an example to other countries of what they can expect if they are, you know, continually defy decisions from UN human rights committees and are deaf to the appeals of human rights organizations and things, you know, that they could end up losing standing, losing investment, losing or certainly degrading important partnerships they have with other countries and other organizations.
Yevgeny, what would be your thought on that? I mean, we are talking about the takeaways from Askarov's death under this circumstances. What should be the takeaway for you, for us, for the authorities, for the international community?
I think that there are two things probably to address. First of all, no impunity. No impunity. We should not forget that, and we should move forward. When Askarov was alive, we have to be more insistent and consistent in, for example, enlarging the Magnitsky list or something like that. We have to work very hard to bring them accountable, at least on the informational area, at least with some kind of sanctions and so on, individual, if it is not possible to have sanctions against the country. Remember the Andijan events in Uzbekistan and how it ended up in the European in the Europe. It is my first point, that we have not to allow impunity and to move forward with all these type of tools like Magnitsky list and something like that. And secondly, what is important, and what was already said by somebody of the contributors, is about we have to bring all names on the top, not only the people who we know, whose names are well known, because it's hundreds of people, it's sometimes thousands of people. We have to make it. It will provide the moral support on one hand, and it will create certain kind of quantity of the cases to make this certain regime to respond and to be accountable and to be held accountable, because it's very difficult to work with such regimes, especially with the like Turkmenistan, where it's, you know, this proof you are alive campaign and something to make these campaigns to bring this on the top and no impunity. This is the key result of this tragic death of Askarov.
Steve, what about you?
Well, I would second a lot of what Zhenya just touched on. I mean, I just in reflecting on what works and in terms of getting political prisoners free, of course, as Zhenya said, it's very individual. And, you know, I continually was surprised at the lack of momentum or ability to break through on Kyrgyzstan in Askarov's case, even when you had several European countries offering to provide him with humanitarian resettlement in a way, you know, offering the Kyrgyz authorities a quick out in a way, you know, the not the most honorable path. You know, we've seen that before when Central Asian governments quickly release but then sort of expel their own citizens. And even in that case, we still didn't see momentum and progress. So it does baffle the mind, and it's difficult to know what strategy works. But some lessons that I've learned over time is that you want to tell the story of a political prisoner as a person. You really want to find those details that remind all of us how outrageous the conditions are. So in the case of one prisoner I remember in Uzbekistan, Murad Juraev, who was also tragically passed now but was released, you know, he didn't put his prison slippers in the right corner of the prison cell one day, and he was given an additional 3 to 5 years for that violation. And we would try to point out the absurdity, the farcical nature and the cruelty of the system in a way to engender more sympathy. And that was one way that, you know, you would get the attention of a diplomat that you were meeting with who maybe only had 10 minutes to spend on that case. And, you know, another quick lesson is the importance of providing solidarity in addition to what Zhenya said about no impunity, solidarity. So, you know, I recently met another former political prisoner who said that the letters he received from hundreds of students over the years, thanks to the efforts of Amnesty International, really did keep him alive. Another lesson is that pressure does work, that, you know, it's no coincidence that the political prisoners that were released, for example, in Uzbekistan, were the ones that were consistently raised by organizations and people. I also agree, sanctions. You know, Global Magnitsky is this powerful tool, and some people are already discussing that all the officials involved in Askarov's death should be put on a sanctions list. They should have their visas denied, their assets frozen if they have any. That's very important, and there needs to be a meaningful investigation. And finally, the financial consequences, the aid, the IMF loans, the World Bank programs, that all really needs to be, in a way, there needs to be unity among the policymakers, that they will bring all the pressure to bear that they can for Central Asian political prisoners. We see right now, recently, the outrage and the momentum around the Uyghur issue in China. We saw a whole new piece of legislation passed in the U.S. Congress on that. Imagine what would happen if we had that sort of focus on Central Asia political prisoners in a region with far less clout and power, you know, than China. I think you would see quicker results. So, you know, I'm always one of those people calling for pressure to be brought in a principled way to support these cases and these families and these courageous human rights defenders, journalists, and other political prisoners.
Thank you very much, Steve. Yeah, I think with this, unfortunately, we have to conclude the Majlis podcast right here. Thank you very much, Steve Sabarlu, Associate Professor of the Practice of Human Rights at the University of Southern California. Also, big thanks goes to Aygul Bekcan, who was joining us today along with her father, Muhammad Bekcan, a former detainee in Uzbekistan, Yevgeny Zhovtis, the director of the Kazakhstan-based International Bureau for Human Rights and Rule of Law, Bruce Panier, the editor of Radio Free Europe, Liberty, Central Asia blog, Kishlok Owazi. Thank you very much, colleagues, for your time in Tats today. And this is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, Radio Free Europe, Liberty's media manager and host of the Majlis podcast here in Washington, D.C. Until next week, bye-bye.